Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
But first of all, I suppose a very happy Easter to everybody. I hope you have the same kind of sparkling day that we have here on the East Coast and that you're going to enjoy it today. But we start with that overnight breaking news in what Donald Trump called one of the most daring search and rescue operations in U.S. history. The second U.S. crew member from the downed F-15E in Iran was rescued by special forces early this morning. That's according to multiple U.S. officials and confirmed by President Trump.
We have breaking news out of the Middle East, where CBS News has learned that the second American crew member from the downed F-15E in Iran was rescued by special forces Sunday morning local time, according to multiple U.S. officials.
This was really a race against time. From the moment that F-15 went down, it was a race for U.S. forces to try to retrieve both pilots. You know, separate from this event, there was another plane that went down on Friday. We had an A-10 that was shot down. That pilot ejected and was rescued, and he is safe. From the moment this F-15 was shot down, it was a race. So combat search and rescue assets were launched, and they were able to recover the pilot of that F-15. However, they were not able to rescue the weapons systems officer. The weapons systems officer had been hiding with essentially no more than a pistol to defend himself for the last 48 hours. And so multiple U.S. military assets came into play, along with intelligence capabilities, cyber operations came into play, even our space assets came into play in order to rescue this American.
And that was CBS News' Clarissa Lawson and James LaPorta there. The conclusion of this episode comes as Trump administration officials have made repeated claims that the war is essentially won and that the U.S. has air superiority over Iran. Well, now it's time to look at the Easter Sunday newspapers. We'll flash through the headlines. First of all, the Business Post, bleak, more pain in store as fuel to hit €2.30 within days. The Sunday Independent, public are braced for recession, according to a poll contained within that paper. The Sunday Times, plans to bail out squeeze middle as fuel crisis bites. So a theme running through those papers there. And a final one for the moment, no blocking. Seven new asylum supercentres. This is according to the Irish Daily Mail. On Sunday, the government is accelerating plans to introduce legislation which will allow the construction of seven supersized asylum accommodation centres which will be immune to public planning objections. And if they think that one will fly, I think they have another think coming. I'm joined by Mark Hennessy, who's the Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Pat.
You've been going through the papers in more detail.
Yes, indeed, and obviously overtaken somewhat by the events overnight with the rescue of the pilot. However, Iran and the Middle East crisis generally dominates all over, both in terms of what's happening there and what it means for us over coming months. And what it means for us could be quite bleak, depending on how things shape up.
Well, according to the front pages of the newspapers, yeah, they're all majoring on recession and fears of fuel price hikes and so on, and what the government might be able to do.
It does, and clearly government can't solve every problem. But we have got into an environment in the last decade with COVID and elsewhere where government has been expected to make interventions in society that would have been unthinkable for a government to have made in years past. And clearly those demands are going to be there again. Now, the difficulty that they have is every action that they take and every cut in excise or whatever it is that they take is eaten bread the minute the
sure.
cut is
and
made.
And then they have the job when this crisis abates, which it will surely,
of trying to
reinstate
excise. That's the point. And clearly, what they've done already in terms of fuel is costing $200 million in terms of reductions to the exchequer revenues. And clearly, there's an opportunity to do more, but it comes with a huge cost. And as you say, to try and put those taxes back when this crisis finally passes, assuming that it does, is going to be immensely difficult. And that's always going to be at the back of the minds of people in finance and around the cabinet generally. And they will always therefore be seen as being slow in the public mind in terms of whatever action that they take. They'll never get credit for it because it'll always be, look as if it was beaten out of them.
Yeah, and we'll be talking later on about Sean Lamass and his legacy and how he handled decisions. His most important thing was you make a decision, even if no one agrees with it.
Yeah.
Making the decision is probably the best thing to do. But if you take more strategic views, as Lamass did, I'm thinking of the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde. She was talking to The Economist, I think last week, and she's thinking that the markets may be overly optimistic about the impact of the Iran conflict and that a return to normality could actually take years. Have a listen to this.
We are facing a real shock that is probably beyond what we can imagine at the moment. Well, maybe they're overly optimistic and determined to stay optimistic in the hope that their positive scenario will materialize and we will be back to normal in relatively short time, which is not what the technical experts are telling us in terms of capacity, extraction, refinery, distribution, because too much has already been damaged and there is no way that it can be restored in a matter of months. Most people are actually talking about years. What I think might also happen, because we've experienced it, is that you understand the actual consequences gradually as you read through the facts, the supply chain consequences, the kind of raw materials that is critically important for particular manufacturing. I'll give you an example. Ilium, which transits through the Strait of Hormuz, is critically important for microchips. Well, unless you figured that out, you're not certain that there will be instant or very relatively quick consequences on the cost of microchips because of the rarity that will result from not having available one of the raw materials. And I think this is a crisis where we are learning almost bit by bit, day by day, what the actual consequences will be, what countries will be most affected, what of the commodities will be the most in demand.
So there we are, you know, everything is going to be affected, but we're only learning bit by bit which ones will be.
Yeah, and it's hard to disagree with any of that. I mean, this is going to be something like the 1973 crisis in terms of how it completely upended everything that was taken for granted in the post-Second World War economy, the 30 glorious years, as they always called it in France. And everything changed after 73. And everything is going to change after this in terms of even things like global aviation, using the Middle East as an aviation hub is going to be fundamentally rethought. Lagarde was talking about helium and for microchips, which may not impact too many people here on a day-to-day basis. But for instance, helium is also needed for MRIs.
Yeah.
And you could end up in a situation perhaps 6 months down the road, maybe sooner, where there's a shortage of material like that for things that are absolutely critical.
When you go back to the energy shocks of the 1970s, and I'm old enough to remember cars queuing for petrol at petrol stations. I mean, long queues and some petrol stations saying, we have no fuel, no point in even queuing. The cost of a house, in my own particular case, I bought my first house around that time. In the space of 10 years, it tripled in value. Tripled in value. So I hope that's not what's ahead of us.
Well, no, I mean, you know, clearly the issue, most people are thinking in terms of the issue at the moment in terms of just price. The issue isn't just about price. It's also about supply. And we have a problem here, for instance, in terms of energy security. There are things that we urgently need to do in terms of solar and all of the rest of it, all of which require grid changes that will take 5 years to fix. And there's no way of speeding that kind of work up. So, you know, short-term solutions aren't possible to a lot of the problems we have.
Now, going back to the various headlines about the Iran war, there's a great headline about Pam Bondi. She stood by her man. He didn't return the favor.
Well, she's not the first woman to find that out when it comes to Donald Trump. I mean, the reality is that Bondi and all of the people who've been ultra loyal to him, he is sacrificing them one at a time when it is necessary.
They reckon Cash Patel is head is on the block, ready for the job.
Yeah, exactly. And sooner or later, somebody in that camp is going to wake up to the realization that loyalty is no reward when you're dealing with Donald Trump. At no point in his life has he ever shown loyalty to anybody other than to himself. And she absolutely debased herself in terms of the way in which she dealt with Congress and all of the rest of it. And at some point in the future, if there is a post-Trump world, she could easily find herself facing criminal charges for some of the actions that were taken by the Justice Department.
The extraordinary thing that Trump could pardon himself, it seems, on the way out in, when his term is up in a little over, 3 years' time, or a little under 3 years' time now. But the problem for him is that he can only pardon federal crimes. He can't pardon state crimes.
He
could still be done in New York State, for example, or in other places for stuff that is local to those states.
Yeah, and almost certainly that's going to happen in a great number of cases, because clearly all of their actions have both state consequences as well as federal consequences.
Now, when you're looking at the cost of living shooting up, and I remember Simon Harris actually said something about when this crisis loomed and the war started, this is the rainy day. That's why we have a rainy day fund. So they've got the funds to do things. But then he's encouraging everyone else to take their money out of the bank and put it into a new investment scheme.
Yeah, well, I mean, the investment scheme has a lot of merit to it. Now, clearly, there are issues. I mean, for instance, if you invest in some investment funds, you face a tax bill every 8 years, even if you leave your shares there and you do nothing with them. That the clock kicks in at 8 years. Now, what they're talking about now is creating a scheme whereby there would be no capital gains tax on...
Yeah, and we'll be talking about this in some detail a little later on. But all the papers are having a go at this scheme. The banks indicating that maybe the $170 billion that the Tonnister referred to, not very much of it might be available. And they would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, to be honest, that's the way I read that. I mean, the fact that they are saying that 20 to 30 billion of it could be movable within a short period of time would strike me as being enough to keep people busy for certainly the first year or two of these kind of things.
Is much being made of Metrolink and the departure of Sean Sweeney?
Well, there is a lot of coverage of it, but it isn't clear why Sean Sweeney left.
Now, family reasons.
It does seem to be that and no more. And it's not he isn't leaving because of some inherent crisis within Metrolink itself. Now, he was well regarded. He was seen as being doing a good job, according to anybody who has sight of the way in which these places work. And there were some things that were done during his leadership that showed at least an ability to think outside the box. If you remember the Dartmouth Square issue, where they just went off and they bought 10 or 12 houses.
And people were jumping up and down, but when you looked at the reality of it, they would buy the houses, presumably make sure they were well
kept and well maintained.
Supported. Because, I mean, there were worries about the foundations and so on.
Yeah.
And then they'd sell them again.
Of course.
Probably at a profit. Down the road.
Certainly not at much of a loss. Yeah. And at the same time, they got a legal issue off the table and speeded it up. And if you're going to be spending, 12 or 13 billion on a project, you don't want to be hanging it in the court for 6 months or 12 months because of 10 houses that are worth maybe 30 or 40 million. That makes no sense. But at least there was an ability to think outside the clock. Now, clearly, his departure is going to have some impact on suppliers and companies, because a lot of people in that world have major doubts about the Irish state's ability to deliver a project.
And yet, it has been budgeted for, and they have already, as you say, started to compulsorily purchase the houses or do deals.
Yeah.
So it is going ahead.
It is going ahead, but clearly we're talking about a state that has a confidence problem as much as anything else when it comes to dealing with big state projects. And clearly, none of these issues are going to be dealable or easily dealable in time. For instance, we all give out about BAM and the experience with the National Children's Hospital, but you haven't seen a queue of major construction firms from the international world queuing up to price big state jobs in Ireland, because they all have experiences in the past that make them wary of it.
I mentioned that headline on the front of the Daily Mail, about the asylum seeker centres, seven of them. They'll be huge edifices, it appears. And according to the Mail story, they will be exempt from any planning objections.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, this is going to become a bigger issue again. I mean, immigration has somewhat retreated in terms of importance, in terms of opinion polls and everything else in the last number of months. But, for instance, the Iran crisis and all of that is going to make every other problem, including immigration, worse from the point of view of the government. Costs are going to increase. All of this is going to increase public tempers. Now, there's no doubt that under Jim O'Callaghan in justice, that at least the public facing position of the government on immigration is becoming tougher. The language is becoming tougher, and a lot of the actions are becoming tougher as well. And people in the sources quoted in the Business Post story about this are making the point that O'Callaghan gets this issue, quote unquote, in ways that perhaps other people don't. Now, equally, you know, people saying that clearly have their own reasons for promoting O'Callaghan's candidature as a future Fianna Fáil leader or whatever. So you have to take all of this kind of thing under with a major pinch of salt. But equally, from the government's point of view, the plan to build seven new centres, whatever is going to happen, they can create a situation where they say this stuff is immune from court action. It doesn't mean that it's going to be immune from public action in the four or five locations where these new centres are going to go, because they are going to be deeply unpopular wherever you put them.
We have an incurable optimist on the line. He just texted in. Dan is his name. I remember the 1970s oil crisis well. We even still have two books of fuel vouchers left over. Will they still be accepted? Sorry, Dan. They would have been in pounds, not even in punts, and certainly not in euro. Please explain how the government has lost taxes. They are perfectly content to take the usual rate of tax when diesel was 1.69 a litre. Now that it's 2.30 a litre, why are they still not content to take the same level of tax as it was when it was 1.69 a litre? Now, this is not excise. This is VAT.
That applies only to VAT. Yeah. Excise is a fixed charge on the price of a litre.
So they have little enough flexibility in terms of what they do with VAT. There are only a limited number of rates they can apply.
Yeah, I think you're going to see some probably European-wide action that's going to maybe perhaps free up the ground in terms of things like that. But I'm not sure the government necessarily needs any action on the part of Brussels, because the problems are going to be much more acute when it comes to excise and VAT, whereby if they take action now, how do they retreat from that position?
Just back from France, says another, Fiona in Stillorgan, diesel and petrol well over €2, €2.10 to €2.20 per litre. We should not keep reducing excise taxes. Don't let a crisis go to waste. We should be accelerating renewable energy, says Fiona. So if you can afford to buy a new EV, go ahead. But that's the big obstacle.
Well, that's fine for, you know, a certain element of middle-class Ireland, but it doesn't deal with the problems that I was raising a moment ago, that our biggest issue when it comes to renewable is not whether we're reluctant or enthusiastic about buying EVs, but that we have an electricity grid that isn't fit for purpose.
Finally, Mark, a boil-in-the-bag funeral. It's a terrible term, but what is it?
Well, I think they need to find some way of rephrasing it. And obviously, it wasn't their own choosing. This is a case where they use a thing called resummation, whereby the corpse is dealt with by water in a bag at high temperature with acid. And effectively, you reduce the corpse to
ashes. Get this thing out that you can crush then and put it in an urn.
It doesn't sound very good. However, I was just doing some research on it this morning. There's no doubt whatsoever that it is vastly more environmentally friendly than cremations. For instance, there's a huge reduction in the amount of mercury that's burnt off and all of that. And the temperatures that you need to deal with a corpse have to go up to 1,000 degrees. So from an energy point of view, it's extremely...
And they won't be marketing, I suspect, as boil-in-the-bag.
No, it won't.
Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor for the Irish Times, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show. Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.